In Major League Baseball, the Brewers beat Cincinnati 3-2 to stay in the hunt for the playoff berth. Cubs lost to the Pirates by the same score, 3-2. White Sox lost to Cleveland 5-3 in 10 innings. Tonight, the Brewers play the Reds again in Cincinnati. Cubs play again in Pittsburgh. White Sox host Cleveland. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service should be mostly sunny and warm today. A high heading for 79. Some perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year is 68. The record high was 93 degrees set in 1937. Tonight, partly cloudy and 58. For Thursday, partly sunny and 76. Looking ahead a little bit, Friday, sunny and 79. Saturday, sunny and 78. For the weekend, Saturday, as I mentioned, sunny and 78. Sunday, partly sunny, 30% chance of rain, and a high again of 78. Now, 59 Racine, 56 in Kenosha. It is coming up on 11 minutes past 8 for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We want to bring you NPR's live coverage of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg event this morning, scheduled to begin at 8:30. So we are postponing our scheduled interview for today and bringing you an interview that is shorter and should at least roughly fill the time before we join NPR. So again, we'll share today's scheduled interview sometime next week. So here's today's Morning Show interview. Well, you don't have to be a fan of boxing to know the famous phrase uttered by Muhammad Ali, "I float like a butterfly, I sting like a bee." What you may not know is actually the man responsible for that wonderful turn of phrase is someone by the name of Drew Brown, or Drew Bundini Brown. And Drew Bundini Brown was in the corner with Muhammad Ali for 44 of his 61 professional fights, he was there for nearly all of his significant fights and played a really crucial role in Muhammad Ali's career, but not in the traditional sense as a trainer. In fact, it's really kind of hard to sum up the significance of his role in Muhammad Ali's life and career. But we can learn about that thanks to a wonderful new book called Bundini, Don't Believe the Hype, written by Todd D. Snyder, who's an associate professor of rhetoric and writing at Siena College and the author of a previous book that I really want to seek out called 12 Rounds in Lowe's Gym, Boxing and Manhood in Appalachia, which touches on the experience of growing up with a father who was a boxing trainer on the side. And Todd Snyder has explored the fascinating life of Drew Bundini Brown, and I am excited to be able to speak with him about this book published by Hamilcar Publishing. Todd D. Snyder, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
I just have to ask you, you grew up with a father who was a coal miner by day and a boxing trainer by night in that small little community in West Virginia. Were you someone who also boxed? From the sounds of it, it was never any kind of primary interest of yours, but I'm not sure how you could have a father who was a boxing trainer and not at least step into the ring a little bit.
Let me tell you, boxing was the center of my universe as a child. Everyone around town knew my dad as a boxing guy, and you know, he had a series of makeshift gyms. One was in the back of my mother's beauty shop. One was in a Baptist church at a youth center, and he mentored kids there. So my whole childhood was being around boxing and my dad, and at weekends I'm going to the fights with him. And as I got older, he finally let me box. It wasn't until I was, I think, 16 years old that he actually trained me to compete as an amateur. Now, I had a very brief amateur career, and I'll be honest with you, college ended my boxing career, and I'm a much better writer than a boxer. So, you know, even though it wasn't a lifelong passion of mine, I did grow up around the sport. I love it very much. And, of course, Muhammad Ali was my dad's hero. So I grew up believing Muhammad Ali was the greatest thing that ever happened to boxing because, you know, he was the guy who got my dad into it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is very intriguing, I'm so glad you take the time to say this, is you say growing up in Covan, West Virginia, it was not easy for my father to be a fan of Muhammad Ali. That is, Muhammad Ali was somebody who in a number of respects was, in a sense, at odds with the prevailing culture, shall we say, of that little town in West Virginia. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a little town that used to be a coal camp. You know, originally the coal mines came in and they built the churches and the homes and they built the company stores, and the town was unincorporated for years. It was essentially a coal camp. And I come from a long line of West Virginia coal miners, my dad being, I think, a fifth generation coal miner. So all the men in my family worked in either the timber trade or in the coal mines. And, you know, Cowan is a mostly white, you know, sort of Southern Baptist kind of environment to grow up in. So my dad got into lots of playground fights, being a Muhammad Ali fan. I mean, my uncle had fought in Vietnam, and there were a lot of people in the region who they didn't like Ali's braggadocious personality. Of course, Appalachian culture is very humble, and a lot of people didn't like, you know, his religious views or his stance against the war. But my dad, he just loved Ali's bravado, and he thought of Ali as the champion of the underdog. And he saw himself as sort of an underdog in life. So, you know, Ali was his hero. And when my dad was a kid, there was a cattle rack in my grandma's farm, and he used to go out there and pretend it was Madison Square Garden, and he would box people. He would get his buddies to come out and spar him in the cattle rack. So, you know, I grew up, you know, knowing that, you know, racism is bad and exploitive, and that people who are racist are short-minded people. So, you know, I was never allowed to have those views in my house. And I wrote in the book, I probably never would have been able to listen to hip-hop music, which is my passion in life. I love hip-hop, and I teach courses on hip-hop culture, if my dad hadn't loved Muhammad Ali so much. And, of course, Bundini Brown, the guy I wrote the book about, was the ghostwriter for Ali. He was the guy that came up with all those wonderful rhymes. And really, to me as a kid, that's what I liked about Ali the best. I liked Ali, the street poet, the lyricist.
And so this touches on one of the most intriguing things about your book, namely that it is a way for you to combine two of the most intense loves of your life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, boxing was my father's first love, but hip-hop was my first love. And it made writing cool. It made poetry cool. I know this sounds odd to some people, but hip-hop was in some ways my literacy sponsor. Like, I would hear a rap song, and it would refer to Langston Hughes, and I had to find out who that was. So I would never have become an English professor if not for hip-hop's tremendous influence on my life. I grew up in the 80s, so, you know, hip-hop was everywhere. It was the cool, you know, youth culture at the time, and it got me into reading and writing. It got me into wanting to be a writer because these guys fought with their lyrics. They fought with their metaphors and their similes. And in some ways, Ali did both. You know, he would battle rap, and then he would go to battle for real. And I always loved Ali and Bundini in those pre-fight routines. And I always believed, like, why wasn't there a book on Bundini? He had the best seat in the house for, like you said, 41 fights. And, of course, he was with the great Sugar Ray Robinson for 7 years, who may, in fact, be the greatest fighter of all time. So Bundini was the sort of the catalyst between those two legendary figures in boxing. You know, he was there for both. You know, the careers of Sugar Ray Robinson and Muhammad Ali.
We're speaking with Todd D. Snyder about his newest book, which is called Bundini, Don't Believe the Hype. This explores the life and career of Drew Bundini Brown, who was a critical factor in the amazing career of Muhammad Ali. And before that, he was also in the corner of the great Sugar Ray Robinson. One of the things you say, Todd Brown, is that this book you have written is not a traditional biography.
Explain right. What
it is if it is not a biography.
Yeah, you know, would you think of Bundini Brown? He was someone who was full of flash and style and flair and bravado. I just couldn't write a boring history book about Bundini. You got to remember, this guy, outside of his time with Ali and Sugar Ray, he was in the Shaft movies. He played Willie, the gangster from Harlem. He was in The Color Purple with Steven Spielberg. You know, this guy was a pop culture icon who hung out with Miles Davis and all these great jazz musicians and all the great sports writers like Burt Sugar and George Plimpton. So going into the project, I wanted to write something with style and movement, and I wanted it to have a life of its own, and I wanted the reader to follow me through the research. So the opening scene of the book is me getting in the Rolls Royce of Drew Brown III, who was Bundini's son, and him sort of taking me on this journey. So I wanted the readers to sort of experience it with me, this small-town country kid from West Virginia who gets to interview the likes of George Foreman, Larry Holmes, Muhammad Ali's wife, Kalia. You know, I wanted readers to sort of experience the journey with me. So the book does, in some parts of the book, take place in present tense, and then we have those sort of vignettes that flash back to those wonderful moments in Bundini's career. So, you know, I knew this book couldn't be your traditional biography. It had to have life. It had to have style. Because how do you write a boring book about a guy like Bundini Brown, who was probably one of the wildest figures in boxing history?
What is, of course, crucial to the success of this book is the amount of time that you were able to spend with his son, Drew Timothy Brown, the third. And you say, actually, at one point, I want you, meaning the reader, to see Bundini through the eyes of his son. Tell us just a little bit about his very impressive son and what it was like for you to sit down with him and talk with him about his dad.
Yeah, a lot of people think of Bundini as this wild, gregarious, over-the-top character with all these funky rhymes and, you know, the crazy outfits he would wear. People really don't see Bundini the family man, the husband, the father. So I wanted to sort of, you know, take a look at the man beyond his myth, beyond his bravado, beyond his sort of public persona. And I thought the best way to do that is to seek out his son. And we formed a really close relationship. And I worked with his son for 14 months and traveled to his home in Atlanta on several occasions. Now, his son could have a book of his own. He's a tremendous success story. His son went on to become a Navy pilot. He was a fighter pilot. His son was a college basketball player in New Orleans. His son is a successful businessman, motivational speaker. Much like his father, he's a natural-born motivator who wrote a best-selling book in the mid-'80s. So his son is a success story all on his own. And it was so fun to get those inside stories of his father's life. And I got access to his father's personal writings, his father's poetry. I got to hold his jewelry in my hands. I got to really get to see the man beyond his relationship with Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Robinson. So for me, some of the most exciting parts of that research were getting to know the Brown family members who are still alive, who knew the man closely and could tell me about him as a person. Beyond his sort of his public persona.
Right. And of course, in your book, we learn a lot about Bundini's early life, his incredibly difficult childhood with a very abusive and violent father, and the way in which his mother ultimately left the home. And there was a sense of abandonment, of course, that really seemed to touch Bundini for the rest of his life. You also share with us, we leave it to our listeners to read it for themselves, the dramatic night in 1938 when Joe Louis defeats Max Schmeling, one of the most important boxing matches of the 20th century. And this was, in a sense, the start of Bundini's love of boxing. But he himself was never, ever a boxer, I believe. So tell us how he ultimately connected with the world of boxing and ultimately to the great Sugar Ray Robinson.
Yeah, you're right that his life before boxing could be a book in and of itself. I really believe you could write his life story up to Sugar Ray Robinson and that could be its own book because he grew up in very, very poor circumstances in Sanford, Florida. Extremely racist environment to grow up in. The KKK pretty much policed the town of Sanford in those days. And folks will probably remember the Jackie Robinson story about his time at Sanford. This was a tough place to be a black man growing up in sort of poor, disadvantaged circumstances. And when he's 13 years old, he joins the Navy, lies about his age, says he's 18. And he joins up the Navy and travels the world when he's just a teenager. So his life was sort of this fantastic journey. He was a lifelong nomadic kind of guy. He was a traveler. Wherever he laid his hat was his home, so to speak. So, you know, he has his time in the Navy. He's kicked out of the Navy one of the officers calls him the N-word, and he throws the officer over the ship, and he's kicked out. And when they find out he's not 18 years old, pretty much the only reason he isn't court-martialed. So he joins the Merchant Marines, and his time in the Merchant Marines lands him in Harlem eventually, where just through sort of crazy circumstances, he pals up with Johnny Honeyboy Bratton, who is a welterweight champion, who they meet at Sugar Ray's barbershop in Harlem. And through that relationship, he works his way into the entourage of the most famous boxer in history at that point.
And it's interesting that he plays a role which is not that of trainer or maybe any of the other roles that would have been traditionally played by somebody in the corner of a boxer. What was his role for the great, for instance, the great Sugar Ray Robinson, and later for Muhammad Ali? How do we describe that role that he played?
That's a great question. People do struggle to define Bundini. Some people would say, oh, he's not a trainer. He's a cheerleader, or he's just a member of the entourage, or he's, some people call him a street poet or a court jester. I mean, all of these terms have been used in Sports Illustrated and Ring Magazine over the years. But to be honest, in the early days with Sugar Ray Robinson, the work was not glamorous. He would babysit his kids. He would be an errand guy. He was just one of the crew, so to speak. The two met, hit it off, and became fast friends. But eventually, Sugar Ray kind of shows him the rope of how a training camp works. And Bundini becomes his sort of right-hand man, his motivator, his sidekick. And they have that relationship for 7 years. So when Ali meets Sugar Ray for the first time before his fight with Doug Jones in 1964, Sugar Ray sort of passes the baton off to Ali and says, this guy right here is an extreme help to me. He's a motivator. He keeps me sharp. He keeps me happy. He keeps me upbeat. And, you know, you might need him for this Liston fight that's coming up. And, of course, Ali was a huge underdog in that Liston fight. So he brings Bundini to his training camp in Miami, and they become great friends. And that initial training camp is where Bundini coins the phrase, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Ali pulls the upset, and the rest is history, so to speak.
Yeah, I like the you tell the story of Sugar Ray Robinson telling the younger boxer, Muhammad Ali, that he needed someone to watch over him, somebody to keep him happy and relaxed, and he believed that Bundini was the right man for the job. At one point, I think it's you who described Bundini this way: when it came to verbal portraits, he was Leonardo da Vinci. Tell us more about what prompts you to pay him such a lavish compliment.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, you could go to any neighborhood in probably any country, and if you say float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, the person, even if they know nothing about boxing, will probably guess that it has something to do with the great Muhammad Ali. You got to think he coined that phrase in their first couple weeks together. He was just a street poet. He was quick with his words, and he had a nickname for every punch. He called Ali's jab the yardstick. He'd say, use the yardstick, and you know, you can kind of close your eyes and have the visual of a yardstick keeps the other guy away from you. So he was just, he made boxing fun for Ali. And, you know, they had all this coded language that was kind of shared between the two friends. And the best way I can describe it is Kalia Ali, Muhammad Ali's second wife, said they were Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. They were just two ornery boys when they got together. And anyone who's been in a boxing training camp knows it's so much repetition and getting up at 5 in the morning and running and sparring and hitting the bag that if you got someone there to go through it with you and to keep you upbeat and keep you on point, that is a tremendous asset. And Bundini was 100% every day in the gym with Ali. He probably had the most intimate relationship with him out of anyone in the entourage.
Wow. You quote Ali's trainer, or one of his trainers, Angelo Dundee, saying that Bundini charged Muhammad's batteries. And I think you say it very well when you say what Bundini brought to the table cannot be measured by punches. Sadly, life does not end very well for Bundini. By the time he passes away, life is pretty unhappy, and he is essentially penniless. And also there is something around his reputation that in a sense is stained. And although you tell us you do not go out of the way or out of your way to, in a sense, restore his reputation, you do want us to better understand who he was and his significance.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. He had his demons. It was well documented that Bundini was an alcoholic. And he would stay sober for training, but in between fights, he would go on benders and he would fall off the wagon. Muhammad Ali didn't drink. He didn't use drugs. He was a Muslim. He lived a pretty clean life. Bundini was a wild character. He loved the jazz joints. He loved to be in the clubs. He loved women. and, you know, his demons have been well documented. And he's also known for, you know, sort of peddling Ali memorabilia as a side gig. Now, the champ knew about it, and champ could really care less about it. I mean, Ali would wear a pair of trunks in sparring, and Bundini would sell them on the side to make a couple extra bucks. I think Ali would have preferred him do that than to ask for money, to be honest. You know, so Bundini has that sort of reputation as a guy who would, you know, sell memorabilia, and he would sell float like a butterfly, sting like a bee t-shirts to make extra money. But you got to remember, his childhood does tell you much of the story. He didn't go past school. I think he went to the first grade, maybe. He could read at about an eight-year-old level. He was paid in cash. He never signed a contract with Ali or Robinson. So, you know, he would do those things to kind of keep himself afloat, and often the drinking would get the best of him. When he does pass away, you know, Ali is sick with Parkinson's. Ali's retired, and the circus had ended. So you're right. The end of his life does have sort of a somber tone to it. And we don't go out of our way to redeem his reputation, but we do try to explain the demons he had and the abuse he suffered as a kid and explain sort of the whole picture. We're trying to do a panoramic so you can see Bundini's, his ups and his downs. And, you know, there were some pretty traumatic things in his past that probably led to the drinking and probably led to some of the behaviors that showed themselves later in life.
Well,
but their friendship was there to the end, that's for sure.
Todd D. Snyder, he is the author of this book called Bundini, Don't Believe the Hype, Exploring the Life of Drew Bundini Brown. The time is 8:31. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. We're about to join live coverage of NPR from the U.S. Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., where Ruth Bader Ginsburg's body will be lying in state. Just a quick word about tomorrow's morning show. We will begin with the mayor of Kenosha, John Antaramian, talking about the city's pathway ahead. We'll also have tomorrow a special brief interview with Emmy Award-winning talk show host Tamron Hall, who speaks directly about how we can have difficult but fair conversations around the difficult issue of race. Also tomorrow on the morning show, a conversation with Joe Frost, known as television's super nanny, back with a brand new television program. That will be tomorrow on the morning show. Again, we're joining now National Public Radio live coverage, which has just begun from Washington, D.C., as Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's body lies in state in the U.S. Supreme Court building. Hosting National Public Radio's coverage is Steve Inskeep.
Quiet scene here. It's very different from the other night. I was here for a vigil for Justice Ginsburg, which also had the feel of a political rally. There are a lot of political feelings that come out when people have come out to talk about her, because a lot of these people who are paying their respects also do not want Donald Trump reelected. They worry about who will replace her on the court. So that is definitely another major feeling that I'm hearing from quite a few people while I'm out here.
And this is NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. It's really hard to explain the legacy that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg leaves in a career of firsts, the first woman to achieve tenure at Columbia Law School, a person who really spent years at the ACLU Women's Rights Project, painstakingly building a case for human rights to get people, men and women both, out of the box that society had put them in terms of gender roles. She was an enormous figure in the law even before she joined the Supreme Court under President Bill Clinton. And while she was on the court, she did a number of important rulings, including 1996 ruling involving Virginia Military Institute, striking down the VMI's same-sex admissions policy. The school, of course, was state-funded in part, and Justice Ginsburg, in a 7-1 ruling, opened that school to women for the first time.
Aisha Roscoe, a White House reporter for NPR, Danielle talked about the political feelings that have come up with this, and the White House has been careful or tried to be a bit careful about not doing too much while the memorial service is going on. President Trump did say he would try to wait to announce his pick until Saturday, until after these services are over. But obviously, it set off a scramble once this news came out, because President Trump has moved to quickly try to fill the seat. He says he's going to nominate someone and he wants a vote before the election. At the same time, President Trump is planning to come and pay his respects to Justice Ginsburg's tomorrow. So he will be coming to see her body lie in repose.
Are you with Claudia?
Pay his respects. He has left a window open in terms of rushing to name a replacement for Ginsburg. He said he will wait until Saturday to do this. In the meantime, we're seeing a lot of folks even already scrambling on Capitol Hill on who could fill this seat. With Republicans in power in the Senate and a Republican president, they say, despite a similar scenario coming up in 2016,
yeah, I see them on the step.
That they could move forward with these plans because the same party controls the Senate, controls the presidency. And so we could see, even though Ginsburg had expressed concerns about her replacement being made in a rush, as she told our Nina Totenberg, her granddaughter told her that one of her last dying wishes was that she wasn't replaced in this kind of circumstance, but it seems that that is what Republicans are moving towards, and it could happen before Election Day.
And I want to mention now that the casket has been brought to rest inside the Great Hall of the United States Supreme Court, where we expect to hear from Chief Justice John Roberts, among other speakers. We're going to hear a lot about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy. But I want to ask NPR's Kerry Johnson, who has covered the justice system for so many years, for a little bit of perspective on what that legacy is. Kerry, how different, is it possible to identify how different the world is because of this one of nine justices on the United States Supreme Court, and also because of her legal work before she joined the court?
You know, Steve, as we pointed out in talking before the special, Justice Ginsburg devoted herself to the promise that justice would be equal for all people, men and women. And she began to achieve that goal, that enormous goal, even before she joined the court under President Bill Clinton. She got the Supreme Court through a series of rulings to finally acknowledge that the 14th Amendment applied to women equally as well as men, and it carved a new path for both women and men moving forward. You hear from many of her clerks how she went out of her way to find daycare for the male clerks who were serving with her. And once she got on the court, she had, of course, that landmark ruling involving same-sex education at VMI in 1996. And later in her career, Steve, she spoke most loudly through her dissents. She couldn't get the majority to agree with her, but she certainly left a legacy in terms of, in particular, voting rights in this election year and a number of other hot button issues.
I'm glad that you mentioned the dissents, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissents in recent years on a more and more conservative court helped to make her even more of a pop culture icon. And as we wait for the memorial service, a few people are lining into the Great Hall of the Supreme Court. I want to bring in someone who helped tell the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's on the line. Shana Konishnik, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did. Hi, Stephen.
Excellent. And she is the author of Notorious RBG, which was a biography of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and later, if I'm not mistaken, participated in documentaries about her life. What was it about Ruth Bader Ginsburg that excited you as a law student, if I'm not mistaken, as you began studying her career?
Well, I started law school obviously knowing that Justice Ginsburg was a liberal justice on the Supreme Court. I knew that she was the second woman appointed to the Supreme Court, but I didn't have the same knowledge of her career prior to being a justice, mm-hmm. and particularly the revolutionary history that she had as an attorney at the ACLU litigating the fundamental cases that changed constitutional law as it applied to gender discrimination in particular. And in the summer of 2013, between my first and second year of law school, I started the Notorious RBG blog. The day that Justice Ginsburg dissented from the bench in the Shelby County versus Holder case, which the majority of the Supreme Court struck down the central provision of the Voting Rights Act, the most important piece of civil rights legislation in our history.
Let me stop you there for a moment because we are about to begin the service here. There's a portrait of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and let's listen to the service.
Yizmor le-David Adonai ro'i lo echsar b'nodeh she'yar b'tzeini Amei menuchot y'nahaleini nafshi y'shovev y'ancheini v'mag le'tzedek le'man shemo Gam ki elech b'keitz ha'mavet lo yirara ki ata himadi shiftecha mishantecha hema yenachamuni.
We're listening to Rabbi Loren Holtzblatt.
Dishanta v'shemen roshi kosi revaya Ach tov v'chesed yardfuni ko yamei chayai v'shafti b'veit Adonai le'orech yamim. A Psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. God makes me lie down in green pastures. God leads me beside the still waters. God restores my soul. God guides me in the straight paths for God's name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil, my cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of Adonai forever.
The 23rd Psalm.
Today we stand in mourning of an American hero, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In a moment, I will speak to what she meant to all of us, but first, I would like to turn to her beloved family. The justice was a mother, a grandmother, and as we all know, had one of the most extraordinary life partners in her beloved Marty. To each of you, to the justice's colleagues, to her law clerks, and to her court family, the country mourns with you and sends you our deepest love and comfort. To be born into a world that does not see you, that does not believe in your potential, that does not give you a path for opportunity or a clear path for education, and despite this, to be able to see beyond the world you are in, to imagine that something can be different, that is the job of a prophet. And it is the rare prophet who not only imagines a new world, but also makes that new world a reality in her lifetime. This was the brilliance and vision of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The Torah is relentless in reminding, in instructing, in commanding that we never forget those who live in the shadows, those whose freedom and opportunity are not guaranteed. 36 times we are taught that we must never forget the stranger. 12 times we are told to care for the widow and the orphan. This is one of the most important commandments of the Torah. It is the Torah's call to action. And it is also the promise written into our Constitution. As Justice Ginsburg said, and I quote, "Think back to 1787. Who were we the people? They certainly weren't women. They surely weren't people held in human bondage.
The genius of our Constitution is that now, over more than 200 sometimes turbulent years, that we has expanded and expanded. This was Justice Ginsburg's life's work, to insist that the Constitution deliver on its promise, that we, the people, would include all the people. She carried out that work in every chapter of her life. As an advocate arguing 6 times before this court for equal treatment for women and men, as a judge on the D.C. Circuit, and as a justice on this court, and as a path-marking role model to women and girls of all ages, who now know that no office is out of reach for their dreams, whether that is to serve in the highest court of our land, or closer to home for me, as the rabbi of their community. Nothing could stop Justice Ginsburg's unflagging devotion to this project, not even cancer. Justice Ginsburg, midor lador, from generation to generation, we promise to carry forward your legacy. May you rest under the wings of the Shekhinah, knowing that you have tirelessly served us and this great country, the United States of America. Please rise.
We're listening to Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt.
El male rachamim shochein bamromim hametzei menucha nechona tachat kanfei hashchina b'malot kedoshim u'tehorim kezohar harakia mazhirim et nishmat yitarucha batzir leha sheolcha leolama began hayden to hay menuchata ana ba'al rachamim astirei habseter kanafecha leolamim utzror bitzror hachayim enishmata Adonai hu nachalata v'tanuach b'shalom amishkeva v'numar Amen.
Exalted, compassionate God, grant infinite rest in your sheltering presence among the holy and the pure to the soul of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has gone to her eternal home. Merciful One, we ask that our loved one find perfect peace in your eternal embrace. May her soul be bound up in the bond of life. May she rest in peace. And let us say, Amen.
Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt saying that it takes a prophet to imagine that something can be different, and suggesting that Ruth Bader Ginsburg achieved that, speaking to a rather small group of friends and family in these socially distant times in the Great Hall of the United States Supreme Court. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts.
Jane, Jim, the entire Ginsburg family, on behalf of all the justices, the spouses of the justices, and the entire Supreme Court family, I offer our heartfelt condolences on the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That loss is widely shared, but we know that it falls most heavily on the family. Justice Ginsburg's life was one of the many versions of the American dream. Her father was an immigrant from Odessa. Her mother was born 4 months after her family arrived from Poland. Her mother later worked as a bookkeeper in Brooklyn. Ruth used to ask, "What is the difference between a bookkeeper in Brooklyn and a Supreme Court justice?" Her answer, "One generation." It has been said that Ruth wanted to be an opera virtuoso, but became a rock star instead. But she chose the law. Subjected to discrimination in law school and the job market because she was a woman, Ruth would grow to become the leading advocate fighting such discrimination in court. She was not an opera star, but she found her stage right behind me in our courtroom. There she won famous victories that helped move our nation closer to equal justice under law, to the extent that women are now a majority in law schools, not simply a handful. Later, she became a star on the bench, where she sat for 27 years. Her 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions will steer the court for decades. They are written with the unaffected grace of precision. Her voice in court and in our conference room was soft, but when she spoke, people listened. Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest. When it came to opera, insightful, passionate. When it came to sports, clueless. Justice Ginsburg had many virtues of her own, but she also unavoidably promoted one particular one, humility, in others. For example, on more than a few occasions, someone would approach or call me and describe some upcoming occasion or event that was important to them, and I knew what was coming. Could I come and speak? But no, instead, could I pass along an invitation to Justice Ginsburg and put in a good word? Many of you have seen the famous picture of Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg riding atop an elephant in India. It captured so much of Ruth. There she was, doing something totally unexpected, just as she had in law school, where she was not only one of the few women, but a new mother to boot. And in the photograph, she is riding with a dear friend, a friend with totally divergent views. There is no indication in the photo that either was poised to push the other off. For many years, of course, Ruth battled serious illness. She met each of those challenges with a combination of candid assessment and fierce determination. In doing so, she encouraged others who have their own battles with illness, including employees here in the court. And she emerged victorious, time and again, against all odds. But finally, the odds won out, and now Ruth has left us. I mentioned at the outset that Ruth's passing weighed most heavily on her family, and that is true. But the court was her family, too. This building was her home, too. Of course, she will live on in what she did to improve the law and the lives of all of us. And yet, still, Ruth is gone, and we grieve. Let us have a moment of silence for reflection.
Chief Justice John Roberts. And for those just joining us, this is a moment of silence in honor of Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. Heads bowed, flag-draped coffin in the Great Hall between the Roman columns there.
May she rest in peace.
May she rest in peace, says Chief Justice John Roberts, and now we await the next moment in this somber, although we are told relatively brief, ceremony that we've been expecting today. Some people have begun to file out. There were not many people in the Great Hall of the United States Supreme Court in these socially distant days, close friends, close family. I believe I caught a glimpse of NPR's Nina Totenberg, who was a friend of Justice Ginsburg for many, many years. And now people are beginning to file out past her portrait. After hearing Chief Justice John Roberts note that Ruth Bader Ginsburg loved opera, dreamed at one time of being an opera star, he said she was not an opera star, but she found her stage in the courtroom, which was just behind Chief Justice Roberts as he spoke. There's much more to say about this memorial service today. We've been listening to the service for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg from the Supreme Court. This is live special coverage from NPR News. And now let's just listen to a little bit of the service just concluded. We heard Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt from Eidus Israel here in Washington, D.C. As she sang, you could hear her voice reverberate off the stone walls of the Supreme Court, a dramatic and emotional moment. She also described the way that Justice Ginsburg's faith was linked to her life in the law. Let's listen.
The Torah is relentless in reminding, in instructing, in commanding that we never forget those who live in the shadows, those whose freedom and opportunity are not guaranteed.
And then we heard from Chief Justice Roberts, who said that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in fighting for women's rights and the rights of many people, was, quote, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful. And we should mention that although Chief Justice Roberts called her a winner, in recent years she was increasingly on the minority of the United States Supreme Court and became famous, as famous perhaps, for her dissents in a series of cases as she did for rulings in which she was on the winning side, and there were key rulings in which she was on the winning side as well. We mentioned that a limited number of people were allowed inside the Supreme Court building in these socially distant days to see the ceremony, but a larger number of people have been waiting outside, and I believe we're going to go next to Rachel Curcius of our member station WAMU here in Washington, D.C. She's a reporter with WAMU and DCist, and she is outside the court today, and Rachel, what have people been doing and saying as this service has gone on inside?
That's right. I'm not sure how much people are paying attention to the service inside as much as gathering with one another in increasingly large numbers as the hours have gone on in talking about what Justice Ginsburg has meant to them. I've spoken to multiple women who are drawing connections between Ginsburg's legal history and legal record and rights that they enjoy in their personal lives, like the ability to take out a loan or buy a home in their own name. The people I spoke to who are at the front of the line arrived last night around 10 p.m., they tell me, and drove all the way from Pittsburgh. And I've chatted with people who have come from Milwaukee, who have come from Ohio, as well as those who are more local and had much shorter journeys to take to get here today to pay their respects.
It is remarkable, as we were hearing from our colleague Danielle Kurtzleben, how many people feel that their lives, they can identify some way that their lives were changed by one person's work, both outside and inside the Supreme Court.
That's right. It strikes me how personal this feels to so many people that I spoke to. Multiple people have broken down in tears and expressing just how much Justice Ginsburg meant to them as a jurist, as a lawyer, and also as a symbol of someone who they felt like was fighting for them. I know that the service mentioned that she was fighting through illness for a lot of the time in recent years she's been on the Supreme Court. And I think that people felt acutely, at least that I spoke to, that she was fighting that illness for them to stay on the court and continue to express her legal opinions to speak for them.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson is part of the NPR team covering this memorial service today. And Carrie, as you listen to the remarks by the rabbi and the remarks by Chief Justice Roberts in this particular moment in history, what stood out for you?
You know, when the rabbi said to be born into a world that does not see you, that does not give you an opportunity or a clear path to an education, that really resonates in the life of Justice Ginsburg. She had to fight in law school for her place, because at the time at Harvard, where she started, the thinking was that any woman took the place of a man. And she had to fight at Columbia, and she ultimately became a tenured law professor at Columbia and ultimately went on to change, as we've heard, the lives of many people. When the rabbi said that a true prophet imagines a new world and makes it real in their lifetime, that, I think, is a real testament to the work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
It has been remarkable to read the obituaries in recent days and think how much has changed within a single life, a long life to be sure, but as a young woman, as an extremely successful law student and law school graduate, she had great difficulty even getting a job. And there are stories of law professors, who male law professors, who went to bat for her and argued fiercely for men in the legal profession to give her a chance, but that was necessary for her to get a chance. We're going to continue discussing today's memorial service for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg right here on NPR News.